City was once the biggest bank on the planet. Then it needed nearly half a trillion in bailouts just to survive. Yet, this isn't just a story about a financial collapse. It's a story of two men, once friends, then rivals, then enemies, whose falling out shaped the future of global banking. A tale of ego, betrayal, and billion-dollar risks that helped trigger the financial crisis itself. What happened between them? Download my investing app today, Silo Markets, and earn a 1% bonus on your stocks and ETFs every year. Link in description and pinned comment below. Our story follows two people, Sandy Weil and Jamie Dimon, a mentor and a protege. Sandy was a Wall Street legend, and Jamie, fresh out of Harvard Business School, became his assistant long before Citigroup existed. Soon, the two were inseparable, and you might have mistaken them as father and son, but they were by no means the same. Sandy was all about risk. He was incredible in sales and making deals that could make huge sums of money in the short term. Weil had just bought a struggling loan company called Commercial Credit, and together they transformed it into a powerhouse. Much of the story is documented in Duff McDonald's book, Last Man Standing, where he writes, "If a visitor dropped by Weil's house in Greenwich, Connecticut on a Sunday morning, Diamond's Volvo wagon was invariably parked in the driveway, the two men already hard at work by 7 a.m. The combination of Diamond's shrewd number crunching and Weil's vision and salesmanship put the two men on course to make a series of bold acquisitions. Sandy was a visionary and a risk taker, but Jamie was different, defensive, logical, and a long-term planner, a philosophy that would become very, very important later. Even Warren Buffett had high praise of Jamie. Too many people overemphasize the power of these statistical models, but not Jamie. The CEO of any of these firms has to be the chief risk officer. Sandy was the empire builder and Jamie was the fortress architect. The two were the perfect pair. But one incident began to change this. On July 13, 1995, the New York Times published an article titled, "Becoming His Own Man, All About Jamie." Sandy Weil had endorsed the story and even made multiple glowing remarks about Jamie in it. But as he held up the newspaper and saw the column, his attitude began to change. Jamie was the star and not Sandy. To Sandy, this was unforgivable, but that's not all. Weil was horrified by a comment from a member of the board. "Jamie runs Smith Barney." Who the F told Joe Califano to say that? And who chose that photo? Sandy shouted. This article had drawn the curtain on Weil's true nature. He wanted Jamie to succeed, but not too much, only when it elevated himself. The idea that Jamie was the central figure and not him shook him to his core. His resentment and envy was now blooming. Sandy Weil's wife, Joanne, said, "It's not good for Jamie to be getting this kind of publicity." Jamie recounts that Weil's PR people orchestrated it. He knew about it. He knew better and I didn't. But I don't think it was really about the picture. He looked more like a proud father in it than anything else. It was all about Califano's quote. All of a sudden, there was the question, is Jamie really running this place? I think that was what got to him. The two's relationship began to sour from here, and it only took a couple of years for everything to reach a tipping point. The previous year, Sandy's daughter Jessica had joined the company, and he had high hopes for her. She was immediately appointed as the executive vice president of sales and marketing in the company's $55 billion mutual fund division. To put things bluntly, Jessica was the product of nepotism. But there's some nuance here. You could say that Jamie also came from nepotism, because his father worked with Sandy before him. But while Jamie did get a head start, he was also irrefutably brilliant at what he did. So when he quickly outshined Sandy, he began to resent him. Sandy's daughter Jessica, however, not so much. With that, you might think that Jamie and Jessica were enemies, but that's not how it started. They were childhood friends and got along really well, at least for a while. But slowly things began to sour. In 1997, Diamond appointed three executives to an important committee. Jessica was not one of them. She thought this was an insult, and in her eyes, it was a jab at her. Why? Well, Jamie had appointed another woman, Joanne Guggenheimer, but not Jessica. Though it's important to note that Joanne managed hundreds of people, while Jessica only oversaw 18. Joanne made perfect sense, but this somehow enraged Sandy. He thought Jamie was deliberately holding her back. He was furious, but this wasn't true at all. Yet, the final straw for Sandy makes all of this even stranger. You see, Jamie actually wanted to help Jessica. He asked her about her goals, and she said, "Well, I'd love to run the company one day." Jamie told her she needed experience on the retail side since they had thousands of bank branches. And then he put her in charge of all of the California branches, 2,100 of them. This would have been an excellent stepping stone. At least, that's what Jamie thought. Jessica, however, felt a bit wronged by this. And Sandy, well, he was hysterical. Sandy stormed into Jamie's office and began to scream, "You insulted her." Sandy wouldn't listen to reason. His daughter had to climb to the top, competent or not. Jessica would resign. Things had gotten too personal. "Jessica, you're not going to be treated properly around here anymore. Not everyone is telling you the truth. Not everyone is telling your father the truth. He's gotten too involved." From this point on, Sandy and Jamie's friendship had crumbled. Sandy had a deep resentment for Jamie, and now Jamie was beginning to feel the same way. Then Sandy decided to retaliate and did some things that he'd regret for the rest of his life. Sandy began to subtly undermine Jamie left and right. The first came on September 24th, 1997. The company, called Travelers at the time, bought Solomon Brothers from Warren Buffett. Everything was going well, except one change that was eerily directed at Jamie. Despite Jamie running Travelers alone and very successfully, Sandy decided he would share the job with the CEO of Solomon, Derek Maugham. Jamie tried to argue with Sandy, but he wouldn't budge. As the chairman of the board, there was nothing Jamie could do, and things would only get worse for Jamie from here. In 1998, Travelers Group merged with Citicorp to form Citigroup, making it one of the largest banks on the planet. In the merger, Sandy was the CEO of the company, and Jamie would now be president of Corporate and Investment Bank. But he would now share the role with Victor Menezes, Citicorp's head of commercial banking, as well. Add in Derek Maugham, and there were now three co-CEOs under Sandy. Very strange. Bad enough for Jamie, but what came next was worse. He and Sandy went over details of the deal, and he informed his long-term lieutenant, "Jamie, you're not going to be on the new board." Jamie was outraged, but why was this a problem? At the time, almost all presidents were on the board of directors, but not Jamie. All Jamie had was an empty title. "I should have left the company at that point. You'd think by then I might have figured it out. But I didn't." Sandy knows exactly how far he can go. "I loved the company. It was my family. I couldn't leave them." But Sandy doesn't always think about just right or wrong. He thinks about his options down the road. "The board decision was the sign, and I should have known better." But there was another pressing issue. Jamie Dimon and Derek Maugham, both co-CEOs, were essentially also enemies. Their company was losing badly after the collapse of a gigantic hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management, which had hurt the global market and especially Citigroup. Jamie criticized his co-CEO at every turn, but Sandy just saw Jamie's counsel as negativity and naysay. Then, on October 30th, 1998, Sandy sat Jamie down and told him, "We want you to resign." It all felt too personal. All the past decisions felt very targeted at Jamie. Why oust the man who was so integral to the success of the company? It was their differences clashing, sure, but deep down, it was Wiles' long resentment. All Jamie could say was, "Okay." After stepping down, Jamie sold all his shares with Citigroup. He severed ties with most people who had surrounded Sandy and worked against Jamie. With Jamie gone, Sandy's plans became bigger and riskier. They were the biggest bank in the world, but things were about to get even crazier. Since 2017, we've published over 1,050 videos and racked up 160 million views. Yet, somehow, we still haven't reached 1 million subscribers. That conversion rate is almost as bad as Citi's $500 billion bailout. If you've been watching without subscribing, I would really appreciate if you hit the subscribe button so that we can finally make 1 million a reality. From here, we need some important context. Sandy wanted a gigantic banking empire, but his biggest obstacle wasn't actually Jamie, it was something called the Glass-Steagall legislation. After the worst financial crash in the world in 1929, the US government realized there was a big problem with banks and risk. They held everyone's money, but in order to make more money, they'd make risky investments. To prevent another global financial crash, banks were split into two broad categories: investment banks and regular banks. But there was another problem. Under this law, Citigroup, Sandy's big merger, was technically illegal. Travelers Group, Sandy's company, was an investment bank which traded securities, but Citigroup was a regular commercial bank. After the merger, Sandy was given 2 years to sort this out and remove all the violations. That, however, wasn't his plan. He was trying to lobby to remove Glass-Steagall altogether. Following the merger announcement on April 6, 1998, Wall immediately plunges into a public relations and lobbying campaign for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Sandy and others in the banking industry spend millions lobbying for the removal, to replace it with the House Resolution 10 legislation. He lobbied so hard, in fact, that the act was nicknamed the Citi Travelers Act. Then he got his wish. In May 1998, the House passed legislation by a vote of 214-213 that allows for the merging of banks, securities firms, and insurance companies into huge financial conglomerates. After 12 attempts in 25 years, Congress finally repeals Glass-Steagall, rewarding financial companies for more than 20 years and $300 million worth of lobbying efforts. Supporters hail the change as the long overdue demise of a Depression-era relic. This one change in legislation would have catastrophic consequences, but for now, the financial world was free game for Sandy Weill. But let's change course for a second. What happened to Jamie? In March of 2000, he moved to Chicago to head the struggling Bank One. Not a cozy job by any means, but it was Jamie's chance to prove what he could do, without Sandy Weill breathing down his neck. He quickly turned things around, cutting down bloated costs, improving efficiency, fired underperforming executives, and set a very strict risk and cost discipline. Soon, Bank One was thriving and very quickly had its own merger in 2004, with a bank you might have heard of, JP Morgan Chase. The $59 billion merger also saw Jamie rise to the CEO of the joint company in 2005. There were two strangely different giants in US banking. Jamie at JP Morgan was preparing for steady long-term defensive growth, but Citigroup was different. It aggressively moved into subprime mortgages and invested heavily into mortgage-backed securities, MBS, and collateralized debt obligations, CDOs. These were bundles of home loans that banks bought and sold for quick profits. Citigroup's share price quickly climbed and reached a market cap of $350 billion in mid-2000. Revenue also reached $89 billion in 2006, with a $29 billion profit. But Citigroup's risk was also through the roof. That year, Sandy Weill retired as chairman in 2006, and soon, Sandy would watch his empire collapse before his very eyes.
Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt, and financial markets from Asia to Europe are doing their utmost to prevent Monday from turning from dark to black.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets. The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend.
Some people say this doesn't stop until the housing hits bottom. You think that's true?
I think that's probably correct.
Citigroup had ignored all the risks, invested too heavily into subprime mortgages, and now it was all collapsing. In 2008, their revenue plummeted and they had lost $53 billion in a single year. Yet, what makes this so ironic is that Sandy is at least partially responsible for all of this. Time even named him as one of the people to blame for the financial crisis. They had become too big to fail, and while doing so, moved into risky securities. This was really, really bad for them, but for everyone else as well. While giving bailouts to all the banks Citi needed the most, in cash and guarantees, they received over $476 billion. In 2008, their debt passed $570 billion, and they never truly recovered. So, what about Jamie? Did JP Morgan collapse too? Well, Jamie had stayed cautious. At JP Morgan, he pulled back from CDOs early, he beefed up the company's liquidity, and created the phrase fortress balance sheet and drilled it into the company's culture. So in the crash, their revenue dropped a little, but they were completely fine. They were one of the few banks to stay profitable in the financial crisis. In fact, they didn't even need a bailout. But the government insisted that they take it so that other banks don't look bad. JP Morgan Chase did not ask for, nor did we need, a capital infusion from the federal government. Our capital ratios remained well in excess of recommended regulatory levels throughout the crisis. However, federal officials asked us to set an example for others by accepting the TARP funds as a sign of support from the government's actions to strengthen the economy. I should also mention that they paid back the funds the very next year. JP Morgan Chase was fine thanks to Jamie. He continued to lead JP Morgan as the largest and most successful bank on earth, and still leads it 20 years later. What's also ironic is that after the 2008 crisis, Sandy started pushing for the breakup of big banks.
I think what we should probably do is go and split up investment banking from banking, have banks be deposit takers, have banks make commercial loans and real estate loans, have banks do something that's not going to risk the taxpayer dollars.
A good mentor doesn't compete with their student. They should never feel threatened by their success and instead should celebrate it. Their goal should be to see their protege surpass them. But when Weil realized Jamie was outshining him, he began to resent him and soon hate him. Sandy wasn't a mentor in the traditional sense. He was much more sink or swim, and he just shed people left and right who didn't meet his standards. I learned a tremendous amount from him. To do the deals that we did, I look back at those and think, God, Sandy, you had guts. Despite his mentor turning on him, Jamie had come out on top, and Sandy eventually realized his mistake. I think I made a very bad decision on succession, he said. Jamie obviously had far fewer blind spots than most people in this business, as he's outperformed most of them. If you'd like to earn a 1% bonus every year, consider transferring over your stocks and ETFs to Salo Markets. But until then, I'm Hari, and I'll see you guys on the next one.